They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:12 Wednesday, August 24th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and this is episode 151, a number I still can't think of to this day without wanting to vomit just a little bit. If you know, you know.
Hi, I'm Bill Finley from the Thoroughbred Daily News. I'm a correspondent. Joe, I'm sorry, that went right over my head. I don't get it.
What's with John going? I'll explain.
All right. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And guys, I am so excited about the Run Happy Travers group that have been assembled for that race that I'm going to recommend that they upgrade the race to a grade zero. That's how impressive I think this group is.
Get John on the American Great Stakes Committee. We'll print up we'll do campaign ads. We'll get a bus and everything. That's the goal for 2023, is to get John on that committee. That's the really important one, honestly. Of all the committees John's going to get on, the boards John's going to get on. But anyway, Bill, no, it's just very degenerate stuff. Bacardi 151, 75.5% proof. And when you're young and you need the bang for your buck, if you're going out and drinking, that's what happened. So to this day, I can't hear 151.
So you wound up praying to the porcelain god when it was all said and done, right?
Exactly. You got it. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Don't forget, the Keeneland September Yearling Sale begins Monday, September 12th. You can learn more and check out the catalog, which has over 4,000 yearlings in it, at theworldsyearlingsale.com. Okay, so it was all about the fillies this past weekend, the three-year-old fillies. Elsewhere, there wasn't all that much exciting on the racing calendar, but we had two very special performances by three-year-old fillies over the weekend. The one that's going to get the bulk of the attention is Nest in the Alabama, obviously, and she was great. We talked to Aaron Wellman from Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners yesterday about her. It was a really good interview. We'll check that out in a little bit. But she's the top of her class. She pretty much locked up the three-year-old Philly Championship on Saturday. Don't see how Secret Oath or somebody else is going to catch her now. Now she's got three grade one wins and a second in the Belmont. So that's a pretty bulletproof resume for a champion. But then the other horse, Moira, in the Queen's Plate, was so good looking. And I honestly had not known that much about her because, you know, I don't follow Woodbine Racing super closely. I know John probably does a little bit more because he's got Mark Cassie on the team, but she could not have looked any better. Just to have that special kick for like 3/8 of a mile like she did is just, it's really rare. And I'm a huge Ghost Sapper fan, so I love to see a daughter of Ghost Sapper succeeding at the highest levels. And honestly, visually, I thought she might have been even a little bit more impressive than Nest, but they were both super, super nice fillies with great performances. What'd you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I completely agree. They stole the show, and these were the two marquee races. Nest ran, no surprise there. The only surprise would have been if she got beat after she ran so good in the coaching club. She won the coaching club by 12 and change lengths. That didn't happen, but it didn't need to happen. I think she won by 4 lengths over Secret Oath. But, you know, what she's done is she's in a class by herself. Secret Oath, don't take anything away from her. She is the Kentucky Oaks winner. She finished second behind her two straight races, but she's just not as good. I mean, there's no other way to put it. She just simply isn't as good. So, that's a big accomplishment to win the two grade ones at Saratoga, the coaching club in the Alabama. We'll see if she runs now between now and then between now and the Breeders' Cup. Later on, you're going to hear from Aaron Wellman on that very subject. In hindsight, it was absolutely the right thing to do to go in the Alabama. I know that, I had in print had brought up the possibility that maybe she should go in the Travers. But when you're going to be 1-5 or 2-5 or whatever she is for a grade one in Saratoga, I think they did the right thing. You grab it. You don't let that slip out of your grasp. Also, it's interesting. She only got a 99 buyer in there, and that would not have won the Travers. Now, that doesn't mean she couldn't have stepped it up and run a little bit faster in the Travers, but that wouldn't have got it done. So switching now to the Queen's Plate, you're absolutely right. I mean, Moira's really, really good. And, so many things to talk about here. You know, this race, the fillies are like every bit as good as the boys. They win it like almost half the years now. And, she comes in there, she throttles the boys. She's now on pace to perhaps go in the Canadian Triple Crown. I know Kevin Attard, the trainer, hasn't fully committed to the Prince of Wales Stakes yet, but it sounds like he is going to go there. That's the race on the dirt at Fort Erie. I tell you, what I want to see from her now is that we haven't had a Queen's Plate winner in ages step out of the comfort zone of Ontario and come to the U.S. and win major races. No one's done it really since Awesome Again in 1997. I think this one is good enough. I mean, I don't know if we'll see her in the States this year because she can focus on the Canadian Triple Crown. But I think next year when she'll be four, you could see her in races like the Personal Ensign being run this Saturday at Saratoga, that sort of thing. You know, she has to beat Open Company after beating up on Ontario Breds. But yeah, she's really good.
And don't forget, she won the Queen's Plate against the boys. I mean, it wasn't just that it was against Ontario Breds. It was against the whole gamut of Ontario Breds. You know, the majority, if not all of the other entries were colts or geldings. And she blew them away, won by seven lengths and a hand ride in a new track record. I mean, so it wasn't even like that the rest of the field was kind of sucking wind. Moira was actually, you know, accelerating at the end and going a mile and a quarter. That's really impressive. And I think you guys have talked about that, you know, ad nauseum. But Moira ran a phenomenal race. And Joe, like you said, a ghost zapper out of an unbridled song mare, you'd expect her to go a mile and a quarter. You'd expect her to go even further if could be. But just a really talented filly and a special filly up in North. Up in Canada. Let's also spend a minute, if you guys don't mind, talking about Spenderella, who also won a grade one, the Del Mar Oaks out in California. And here's a New York bred that they brought all the way to California. Grand Motion trains her and Gainsway is the owner. And, you know, kind of went counterintuitive and went out west and won that race really impressively with Tyler Gaffney out. Again, 91 buyer isn't going to get anyone excited, but visually, in the eye test, Spenderella looked really, really good winning that grade one. Yet Feb Rover, who came in and, you know, and won the Canadian stake for also for Team Cassie. And then, you know, guys, we talk about Nest and just how good of a filly she is. And it's amazing. You know, we're very fortunate to be sitting here and talking about a filly like Nest and Secret Oath and other fillies that are just continually impressing us and doing well on the racetrack. And Nest, I think from the beginning of this year, especially, has just shown time and time again that she is the best 3-year-old filly in the country. I know Secret Oath beat her that one time. And Aaron Wellman talked about the fact that this was an important race because it was the rubber match. It was the third race, against Secret Oath. But I think going this distance, especially going a mile and eighth, going a mile and a quarter, like she did over the weekend, that there are few 3-year-olds in general in the country that can beat her at that distance. And it's really, really impressive. And guys, I want to remind you that one of us talked about the fact that Nest, you know, with the right circumstances, Nest could be horse of the year. So let's play that clip. You know, at that point in time, does that give Nest the resume to be horse of the year? If she beats the boys, you know, finish second in the Belmont and then wins the Travers and then beats all the girls in the distaff. Wouldn't that make a compelling argument for her as well?
Hey, I want to jump in. You guys both bypassed on the biggest story of the week. And Joe, you in particular, Chubwagon got beat on Tuesday at Parks. How weird is this? She's 12 for 14 lifetime. Both of her losses have come in the running of the Dr. Teresa Garofalo Stakes for Pennsylvania Breds. What is it about that race that she doesn't like? And also, it was noteworthy that they fired the trainer. Did you notice that? Guadalupe Preciado got the boot, and this was her first start running for a trainer by the name of Regina Brennan for those connections. We love Chubwagon. She'll be back to fight another day. Nothing wrong with 12 for 14, but Joe, I'm surprised that you were able to get out of bed Wednesday morning.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to admit it. I didn't want to admit it to myself that she had actually lost. So I think John wasn't done. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, can we talk about one other really impressive race? And that was Echo again, you know, winning at Saratoga. First time starter, a gun runner, a homebred of Winchell, and just put on a display. I mean, was bet down to even money. So everyone expected the horse to win, but won impressively, you know, really gate to wire, 94 buyer for the son of Gunrunner. And you know, you look at programs, and last year we talked about how good Darley was doing and all the Darley breds and how they were, it was an embarrassment of riches having so many horses, you know, and all these grade ones. How about the Winchell Asmussen connection? You know, they have Echo again, who looks like he's going to be a Breeders' Cup juvenile. They, same connections, won the Jim Dandy with Epicenter and also won the Amsterdam with Gunite. All homebreds of Winchell, all trained by Asmussen and all ridden by Rosario, by Santana.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of numbers, like nobody plays at the top level, I don't think, compared to their numbers better than Ron Winchell. You know, not more than a few dozen horses. And just always seems to pop up, especially in these two-year-old races and these grade one and these high-priced maiden races always seems to do well. They had another one, or Three Chimneys actually had another one, another gun runner on Sunday that was a borderline rising star for me, Grand Love, who looked really speedy and good. And she jumped back to her wrong lead and didn't look great in the last 16th, but overall looked very, very sharp and very fast. Echo again was really good as well. There was a Bob Baffert horse on Sunday at Del Mar named Home Cooking, who I made a rising star, who looked great. Daughter of Honor Code, was really bet hard first time out, ran third, and this time came back and won by almost 10 lengths. Was just could not have been more impressive. And you would think my Honor Code is going to want to stretch out too. But just going back to Moira for a second, because this wasn't a one-off. Like going into this race, she won the Woodbine Oaks by like 100 lengths right before that. So she had stamped herself as a quality filly. And it's so interesting for me now, because like you guys say, you know, there haven't been a ton of Queen's Plate winners who have gone on to have impacts in open races in recent years. But like, you know, Go Sapper out of an unbridled song mare, not only is she bred to go long, she's bred to like dirt too. So that's the next thing that we have to see with her, I think, is to see her try one of these big dirt races. And I'm super excited for it. And it was a nice story, too, because Kevin Attard, who we've had on the show before, had never won the Queen's Plate before. Obviously, his family is, you know, steeped in the tradition of Woodbine and Canadian racing. And he hadn't won that race yet. So that was a cool little side note to that. And she's just crazy exciting. As for Nest, like, you know, I saw some people being like, well, it was only a 99 buyer. I don't care what the buyer figure was. The pace was such that she wasn't going to run 2 minutes flat. The pace, they almost went 50 to the half. You're not going to do that in a dirt race and then run 2 minutes or 201 for a mile and a quarter. The important thing for me was she has that turn of foot. And I think that that's what makes her so special. You go back and you look at the Ashland, and it's why we liked her going into the Oaks most out of that big four, was that turn of foot and that monster stretch kick that she had in the Ashland. And we've seen that again in the Coaching Club American Oaks. We saw it in the Alabama. You just don't see two-turn routing dirt horses who have that kind of acceleration the way that she does. And she's going to be a deserved champion. I wrote on Twitter that I feel kind of bad for Secret Oath, because in any other year, she would be the clear front runner for the three-year-old Philly championship. You know, you win the Kentucky Oaks, you're third against Boys in the Arkansas Derby. You got a couple other stakes wins as well, but she's obviously probably going to finish second to Nest at the end of the year. We wanted to mention this before we wrap up the weekend. Bill had a great, great story in his week in review about a favorite of the show, Uriah St. Louis, who won the Island Stakes on Saturday, 14-1 shot, informative. I wonder what the shortest price is that he ever has won a graded stake at. It's got to be like 10 or 11-1. I can't imagine him winning in single digits, but that's what we love about him. Like he is the antithesis of all the trainers who just keep their horses in the barn and are scared of the bounce and just duck and duck and duck and look for the softest spots possible. He, you know, and Bill wrote this, he can do this because he owns his horses. He doesn't have owners to answer to. So he can run his horses where he wants to, and it pays off. He won the Jockey Club Gold Cup a couple of years ago, which is a grade one. His stables made over $800,000 this year, even though he's only winning at like 7%. And that's like, you know, that's the dream, I think, you know, unless you want to win an Eclipse Award. To me, that's the dream. You're winning races, you're making money, you pop up and win a big, you know, pot every once in a while. I just want to read the quote from the story and then I'll toss it to Bill. It was because there was a great quote. He said, "We can take chances because we own all the horses. A lot of trainers can't do that. This will be hard for other trainers to do because they don't own their horses. I used to train for other people. It's a real pain because they say, don't go there. I don't like this spot. I don't want to get embarrassed. I ran Discreet Lover in the Met Mile and he finished fourth. I made $80,000. I wasn't embarrassed to make $80,000. But a lot of trainers would not have run him in that race. And that sums it up right there. That's what drives me crazy about the short fields. Like, I get you want to protect the horse's record and all that, but these races still pay well for second, third, fourth place. You can take the hit to your ego and just cash the check, my guys. Like, it does not have to be this constant ducking and dodging whack-a-mole game where you have to get the winner's share of the purse. Otherwise, it's not worth running. So thank you to Bill for profiling Uriah. What else did you think about that story, Bill?
Yeah, you know, Joe, I mean, he's the best 7% trainer there's ever been,
right?
Which is the bottom line in this. And, you know, I get a real kick out of this guy. But, you know, people, he's no joke. And I hope nobody looks upon him that way. And you may say, well, this guy's always running 50-1 shots in grade one races. But, you know, there is a reason why he does this. This is his business. He wants to make money. And, you know, he's not afraid to throw a horse in the deep end. you know, knowing that maybe the best he can hope for is the horse finish fourth or fifth or something like that. But especially in this day and age with such small fields and so many stakes races, for instance, you know, there was another example this year, the same horse Informative who won the Island ran last in the Met Mile. He ran last. And Uriah got a check for $40,000 for running last in there. And then every once in a while, these things like Informative did in the Island jump up and win. It was a $250,000 race. So he gets $150,000. And, you know, his overhead is extremely low because he doesn't have any owners to deal with. Most of his staff, a lot of his staff is his own family. He's buying really inexpensive horses, you know, $15,000, $20,000. Says he shops mainly at Timonium for two-year-olds. And you look down at that $814,000, you know, at the end of the day, that is enough. And he's got 2 months to go, two, three, 4 months to go or whatever, that at the end of the day, that $814,000 doesn't all go into his pocket because of all his expenses. But he says, hey, I'm making money doing this. And honestly, you know, some owners can have good years and bad years, but over the stretch of like 10, 15 years, how many owners in this business do make money? I'm sure the number, you know, we don't know, but the number is not very good. So, you know, this guy's doing something right. And it's amazing nobody else does this. You know, everybody else, okay, I don't want to run fifth in this race because that's going to knock my winning percentage down and I got to be a 25% trainer. Well, you know, you don't have to be a 25% trainer. At the end of the day, if you're successful where it counts, which is the bottom line aspect of his reputation. And Informative is going to be back. He said he's going to run him in the Breeders' Cup. I imagine there'll be about 50-1 in there. And I'm throwing him in on my superfecta tickets.
There you go.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and I just, sorry, John, I just want to jump in and say, like, you can't have it both ways. Because I see people make fun of Uriah. I see people make fun of Ken McPeak when he's talking about, like, running fillies against the boys or going to Royal Ascot or whatever. You can't have it both ways. You can't complain about short fields and then make fun of guys like that who take shots with horses that you might not think make sense on paper. You can't have it both ways. You got to pick one or the other. And that's why we love Uriah St. Louis. Like, I would love to have him on the show, too, and just talk to him about his philosophy because he, you know, absent the significant shrinking of the grade stakes calendar or the stakes calendar, he and guys like him are the antidote to short fields and all of the pitiful grade one fields we have in this country. People who are not afraid to run their horses and maybe run up the track more often than not, but at least take a shot with your horse. I mean, that to me is the essence of racing. I'm glad that there are some people that get it still. Yeah, John.
No, I was going to say, and not only is he, you know, kind of a breath of fresh air. And I know we kind of say tongue in cheek, oh, Uriah's got a horse in the race, but he has figured out his niche in the industry. Like you guys mentioned, the other thing is, you know, I looked on Thoroughbred regulatory rulings, which shows he doesn't, I mean, basically he doesn't have anything. He's got a couple of administrative things for handing in papers late, but he's never had a drug positive. I think they did have one time where he had a positive and then it was rescinded because the test was faulty. So here's a guy who, like, you know, he's got a really cool, interesting niche in the industry. And you're right. We talk about all these super trainers and how important, you know, they are because they control so many races and stuff. Here's a guy who's like, what the hell? Run the horse again. I don't care. You know, and it's not to the detriment of the horse. It's basically like, yeah, if I run fourth or fifth, that's great. And not that he does this with fillies. I think he does it primarily with geldings. But if he gets a filly and runs third in the stake, then, you know, he gets, you know, 10 times what he paid for the horse at that point.
Yeah, no, and if Uriah, if you're listening, or if somebody's friends with Uriah, tell him we want to come on the show. I want him to come on the show because I think that'd be an interesting conversation. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland sales grads swept the grade ones across the country on Saturday with Nest in the Alabama and Spenderella, who's also a New York bred, in the Delmar Oaks, plus Moira, who beat the boys in the Queen's Plate, beat the brakes off the boys in the Queen's Plate. You can't just say she beat them. She's also a graduate of the 2020 Keeneland September sale. We're now less than 3 weeks away from this year's edition of Keeneland September. The auction covers 12 sessions from September 12th through the 24th. Book one includes yearlings out of 89 graded stakes winners and 36 grade one winners, plus siblings to 50 grade one winners. You got to be there. You got to get in on the action. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all, home to the November breeding stock sale and the 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
Maximum Security proves he's the real deal with a gate-to-wire win in the Florida Derby.
Champion three-year-old.
Maximum Security has won the TVG.com Haskell Invitational.
11 triple-digit buyers.
Maximum Security, he smoked them in the cigar mile.
Grade 1 winning four-year-old.
Maximum Security takes them all the way in the TVG Pacific Classic.
Secure your mare's future. Maximum Security.
The TDN Riders Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Ashford sire Mendelssohn really on the rise. He had his ninth winner on Sunday with Classical Cat. It's actually a story in today's TDN about it that you should check out. We won at Del Mar on debut for Phil D'Amato. Mendelssohn has had 9 winners overall and 9 other placers from 27 runners worldwide. I feel like his horses are winning pretty much every weekend now. And fellow first crop sire Motown had another nice winner on Friday with Mo Stash, who won on debut at Ellis. Motown is a top 10 freshman sire with 5 winners so far this year. I think he has 6 actually now because he had one overseas, and he stands this year for just $7,500. So yesterday we sat down with Aaron Wellman, who's the principal of Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners. He's one of the sharpest guys in the game, honestly. I love listening to him talk. We had a great conversation about Nest, about a lot of bigger issues in racing. Check out our interview with Aaron. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are thrilled to welcome back to the show, fresh off of a Grade 1 Alabama win with their superstar filly, the principal of Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners, Aaron Wellman. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Well, always good to talk to you. Obviously, super, super exciting time with Nest. I mean, she was absolutely incredible in the Alabama. I always wonder this because when you have such a big favorite, you know, I think a lot of trainers and owners get a little bit nervous. They start thinking about what could go wrong. How did you feel going into that race, and how did she run compared to what you were expecting?
I felt oddly calm going into the race. She just allows for us to have a lot of confidence. And truthfully, I feel much more nervous going into big races when you don't feel 100% confident or you're a little bit more concerned about your competition, those variables. And of course, a big race, you're 1-5 and you're arguably going for a championship. There's plenty of reason to be nervous, but she had just thrived so well in the month between the CCA Oaks and the Alabama that we went in with a lot of conviction that she was going to go out and perform well again. And at the end of the day, you just got to kind of put it in perspective and admit she doesn't owe us anything, regardless of what happened in the Alabama. So you try to keep yourself grounded as badly as you want them to perform well and earn those championship honors where it matters most on the racetrack. You got to just sort of take a deep breath and stay composed. As far as the performance was concerned, it was nothing short of brilliant. She put on another breathtaking display, and she's just getting stronger and better and more comfortable in her own skin. And it's really a testament to Todd and his program and everybody that's been associated with her from the beginning, going back to Stone Street and Ian Brennan, who broke and trained her as a baby, and all of her grooms, the riders that get on her, Nora, Amelia, Irad, and of course, Todd. But at the end of the day, it's the filly that's doing it out there. And most of the credit goes to her.
Aaron, congratulations. As you said, a terrific performance. After she won the coaching club, Todd Pletcher opened the door a crack, maybe just a crack, but the subject of the Travers came up. How far did those discussions go? How seriously did the ownership group look at the Travers? And obviously, you got a grade one in a prestigious race at Saratoga with a big purse, so you did things right. But in hindsight, any thoughts? Maybe we should have gone in the Travers.
Zero. Honestly, zero. You know, I think it was worth the discussion. And with Mike Rapoli on the team and Todd, of course, you know, we're huge proponents of New York racing. And I think the sportsmanlike real swing for the fences that we took this year was in the Belmont. And we showed that we're not afraid to run against the boys, and especially in a race like the Test of the Champion at a mile and a half over Big Sandy. But at this phase of the season, we had everything to lose and not much to gain by running in the Traverse. With a championship on the line, an Eclipse Award for champion three-year-old filly, if we were to win the rubber match with Secret Oath, as well as, look, it's a really salty field that's getting ready to line up for the Traverse. Good group of colts, strong colts with exceptional form. You've got the Haskell winner and you've got the Jim Dandy winner. You know, we could easily knock her out for the rest of the season. Even if she were to go and beat those boys, we might have been a penny wise and a pound foolish at the end of the day. So we really wanted to work backwards from the Breeders' Cup distaff. And even though it was tempting and we're all sportsmen and want to do right by her, and this filly's gained an incredible following and we want to support New York racing and really create a spectacle, the Alabama in and of itself is an incredibly prestigious race. It's one of the best races for three-year-old fillies on the calendar. We didn't think she had anything to prove against the boys. We thought she proved it on Belmont Day. And we're just very honored for her to be an Ashland winner, second in the Oaks, second in the Belmont, arguably best on the occasion. And now string together those two jewels at Saratoga, the CCA Oaks and the Alabama. It's hard to do. I've been down this road four times previously with fillies that ran in the CCA Oaks and the Alabama. And I've seen how taxing that series can be on horses. So we really view this as a two race series. Oaks, Alabama, and then we'll figure it out whether we run her again between the distaff and now or not.
And Aaron, it's amazing from one racing manager to another. I've always found that it's easy to manage horses when they're not good, when they're claimers or when they're allowance horses, because those races come up in the condition book all the time. But you just laid out perfectly, you know, what race you're working backwards from, which is the Breeders' Cup distaff. Walk us through. She wins the distaff. She wins the three-year-old championship. Is she coming back for year four?
We have every intention of running her back next year. Look, you know, Eclipse is in the business of racing. And while we certainly have a program, an established pipeline of what we refer to as hashtag Eclipse Fillies that we've made a habit out of developing over the course of the past decade, and then selling for seven figures plus at auction or privately, which is a huge part of our program to create these filly assets for our partners. This filly, she's cut from a different cloth than most of our grade one fillies have been, in the sense that she's only supposed to get better. Touch wood, you know, health, of course, is always in the back of your mind. But being by Curlin, out of an AP Indy mare, and we're starting to see her really blossom as we speak. And the thought of her maturing into a four-year-old and beyond is super exciting. And Mike Rapoli is the ultimate sportsman. Mike House, our other partner on the filly, he's getting up there in age and he's having the time of his life. There's nothing like campaigning a filly like this. Those two guys, don't want to speak for them. I don't count other people's money, but I would say that having a filly that's capable of running in the races that she's capable of running in at the end of this year and through next, hopefully, it's far more important than any zeros that they could add to their ledger at this point.
I'll speak for Mike. He's doing okay. I think. You know, one of the things that impresses me about Eclipse Thoroughbreds is that You guys kind of run the gamut. You have a lot of high-powered auction purchases. You have partnerships. But then I see you guys a lot of times pick up horses from around the country who maybe got a nice maiden win at a smaller track, and then you bring them to the bigger races. What is your team and your evaluation process like? Do you have people that focus on the racing across the country and then people who focus on the auctions? How heavily are you involved? What is your evaluation process like at Eclipse?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Joe. I believe that this is really a power in numbers portfolio business. You've got to be diversified, just like any good investment portfolio. And while this isn't your traditional type of investment, and that we don't tout it as far as the purpose being strictly to make money. There's all sorts of other factors that we hype to get partners tied on to the Eclipse program. You still have to have a balanced and well-diversified portfolio in order to stand the test of time, which is what we're trying to do. As far as our evaluation process and our purchase process, at the end of the day, it all falls on my shoulders. I've always believed from day one of founding Eclipse that if we're going to accept other people's hard-earned dollars to participate in Eclipse partnerships, I've got to be the one to answer to them, good or bad. And believe me, there's going to be a lot more bad than there's going to be good. We're going to be wrong a lot more than we're going to be right. And I've never felt as though passing the buck onto a third party bloodstock agent or someone in that realm was the right way to do business, because they've got no connection to our core business and everyday infrastructure. So at the end of the day, I got to look our partners in the eyes, good or bad, and tell them that I either bought them a good horse, which is rare, or own up to having bought them a bad one and hopefully make it up to them. The process is that I'm constantly scouring the globe for talent. We try to be strong in all respects, whether it's private purchases, watching replays of big races all across the country, if not the world, on a day-to-day basis. Sean Tugel has recently joined our program, our company, as Vice President of Bloodstock. So he and I work hand in hand, and we've really tried to fine-tune our auction process at the two-year-old and training sales, where we've bought a lot of good horses, as well as the yearling sales, which have proven to be a hotbed. So, you know, not everybody is good at everything, and I certainly admit that, but we do take a lot of pride in our ability to identify talent, put it in the right hands, develop it, and manage it properly to maximize its potential. And at the end of the day, like I said, I've got to be the one that really looks our partners in the eyes, regardless of result.
And staying on that same sort of theme, you bought her for $350,000 at Keeneland September. You can add a couple zeros on to the end of that now after what she's done. But by Kerwin and the kind of filly she's come, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this, but in this day and age, that's not a lot of money. What did you see that the guy swinging for the seven-figure fences maybe didn't see?
Yeah, it's wild. When I look back on some of our best purchases at public auction, and like I said, I'm not going to scoff at 350 grand. That's a ton of dough. But you're right, Bill. In the grand scheme of this market, a filly like her with her pedigree, and as far as I was concerned, her physicality at the sale, you could have easily have seen her bring double that. And incidentally, that's how we ended up partnering with Mike Rapoli on the filly, because at the time, Jacob West was our VP of Bloodstock, and Jacob was an integral part of our team for a few years, and he's gone on and graduated from Eclipse, and he's now got his own Bloodstock agency and a consignment company as well. So we wish him the best, and he still acts as a consultant for us on occasion. But he had a really good relationship with Mike Rapoli, did a lot of work with the Rapoli program, and of course with Eclipse. And we've bought a handful of horses with Mike over the years. And when this filly came on our radar, Mike, as you guys well know, is predominantly in the market for stallion prospect colts at the yearling sales. And you've really seen it bust through the last couple of years in his partnership with Vinny Viola and St. Elias Stables. They're spending $14, $15, up to $20 million a year on these colts. Mike wasn't really buying many fillies. But when this filly came along, we did think she was going to be $500,000 to $1 million. Somewhere in that range, potentially break through that seven-figure ceiling. So Mike was going to be really selective about the fillies he was going to buy and made sure that he had plenty of pedigree behind them. And credit to Jacob, he shortlisted this filly for me, and we both fell in love with her after we went through our due diligence process. And we thought that we were going to need Mike to sort of minimize that high dollar risk. Well, of course, when we signed the ticket at 350, we're both looking at each other like, what did you need each other for in that instant? Yes. But believe me, it's been a heck of a ride. And look, there's going to be plenty that you think you got to spend $750 on, that you're going to buy for less, that you wish you didn't have a partner on, that you do wish you had a partner on, because they're not going to all turn out to be nests. They're going to be failures. They're going to be duds. And you will have hoped to have minimized your risk. And that's sort of the name of the game right now, is spreading the risk, creating these alignments and partnerships. And I got to be honest, sharing this experience with Mike and his family and his entourage, it's really just heightened the entire ride that much more.
Right. So Aaron, right now it looks like you guys have purchased 5, 6, 7 yearlings already, and we're going right into yearling season with the Keeneland sale right around the corner. Can you give the audience an idea of, you know, how many yearlings you think you're going to buy, and more importantly, which ones, you know, how much of each one would be available for the general public? Because, I mean, you guys sell out pretty quickly, but I'm sure that you hold some back for new partners and new investors.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't have a formula when we go to these sales, to be honest with you. It's all about trying our best to find the best equine athletes with as much pedigree as we could get behind them at the best value for money that we perceive. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder in terms of the recruitment process and identifying the talent. And it's also very much an art, not a science in that respect, but also in terms of valuation. So, I don't go into these sales with any preconceived notion. Obviously, Keeneland is the granddaddy of them all, thousands of horses to inspect and evaluate. And we just really try our best to, again, create a variety and different flavors for our partners. We're unique, I think, in the fact that when we go to these sales, we're not necessarily streamlined, laser focused on stallion prospects. We're predominantly founded on fillies. I think that our equine portfolio is lopsided towards fillies, probably 70, 75% fillies, 20, 30% colts. And we will take our swing on that stallion prospect on occasion, Taproot being one of the first that we really took a swing for the fences on and thankfully hit it out of the park with him. But I believe that to stand the test of time in this business, you got to be Philly centric. And that's really the way we go at it. Our partners have bought into that concept. They believe in it. And as they see their portfolio go through cycles, they're even buying further into it. But I would say you're right, Jonathan. At this point, we've bought a half a dozen between Phasic and Lexington in July, Phasic at Saratoga, and then the New York bred sale. We went 2-2-2. So we're really well balanced to this point, and we could walk out of Keeneland anywhere between a half dozen and a dozen, maybe a few more come September. But again, there's no formula. We don't raise any money up front. We buy everything on the come. So every yearling that we sign the ticket on come September, my business partner, Brian Spearman, and I have to have 100% conviction that if for some reason these prospects fall on deaf ears when we go to syndicate them, we're willing to own 100% of them. And I got to be confident that the athlete, the pedigree, and the valuation is solid enough that we can turn around and hopefully attract our partner's attention. So I would say anywhere between a half a dozen and a dozen we'll look to get at Keeneland. But it's so fun, man. It's what gets me up in the morning. It's what fuels my fire, is trying to find these talented equine athletes and then watch them develop. And Keeneland is the ultimate source.
Absolutely. It's a Keeneland sponsored show. We are contractually obligated to agree with that. But no, you're definitely right. But so this is the last question for me, because it's really fascinating to hear you talk about auctions and partnerships. You know, that's the way of the world now. More and more partnerships at these big sales. On the one hand, obviously, you're thinning out the competition the more you partner with people. On the other hand, you have to pay more for horses these days. So what are some, are there downsides to the advent of the partnership, or has it been mostly gravy for you guys?
Man, that's the $64,000 question, right? So far, it seems to be working for operations like Eclipse, and it seems to be working for the industry at large. Time will tell, as it always does. I think the nature of the business in all respects right now is consolidation. We're seeing that in a lot of ways. But really, the focus is on quality. I think this goes back to when the bottom dropped out of the economy back in 08, 09. I was just starting to become a professional in the business. I left my law practice and boom, you know, the subprime mortgage crisis hit. And it wasn't exactly the greatest of times to be involved in the racehorse business. But I learned a lot at that time. And I think what happened was a lot of big breeders, a lot of owned to race owners realize that you cannot carry a whole lot of fat in your stable, regardless of whether you're breeding or owning to race. And the focus has got to be on quality. The economic model is already against us going into this game. And what has started to make sense, and this goes back to one of my mentors, Cott Campbell, who is the pioneer of racing partnerships. So it's a testament and a tribute to his vision back in the day, is that you got to focus on quality and spread risk. And really where it makes the most sense is trying to compete at the highest level. We still need the claiming ranks. We need the blue collar, everyday owner, trainer, and operation to make this business tick. But if you're going to try to compete at the highest level, you've got to be laser focused in that realm. And I think that's what you're seeing. And we've been very fortunate to have some great alignments with Mike Rapoli, Gary Barber, Gainsway Farm, Bridalwood Farm, Bob LaPenta, you know, some titans of industry that maybe 7-8 years ago, you never would have thought in a million years, the Stone Streets of the world, the Coolmores of the world, the Windstars of the world would ever even contemplate partnering up on a horse. And when you see those titans of industry aligning with other operations, yeah, you get into the back rain at Canelin or you go into the pavilion at any of these auction houses and you see them lining up, you know, you better have your boxing gloves on because it's going to be a war. And fortunately, our alignments have been very healthy and our partners have bought into the concept as well. But it's the name of the game. It's the rule now rather than the exception that partnerships rule the roost. And I think it's here to stay.
Aaron, let's switch gears for a little bit. Aloha West, last year's Breeders' Cup sprint runner, didn't get off to the greatest start this year, but he did win last time out in the Kelly's Landing Stakes. Tell us what's in store for him. And are you guys re-energized with this victory and think that he can again be the type of horse to win the Breeders' Cup sprint?
Yeah, Aloha has been a dream come true for our program. Such a cool horse. Obviously won the Breeders' Cup sprint last year. And we had to start him off in rather ambitious fashion this season. The timetable to get him back to start his season was such that we had no choice or very little choice but to run him in the Churchill Downs on Derby Day. He ran into Jackie's Warrior. I think he ran a better than look third on the occasion. He was buried down on a dead rail and closer to the pace than he really wants to be. So he ran third that day. We took our swing for the fences to try to really escalate his potential stallion value ultimately by running him in the Met Mile against Flightline and Speaker's Corner. He just wasn't himself that day. And although it was really nerve-wracking, you know, you asked me, was it nerve-wracking going to the Nest race? That wasn't nerve-wracking. Bringing back a Breeders' Cup winner on 3 weeks rest off a bad effort in the Met Mile and bringing him into a listed race at Churchill, that's nerve-wracking. And fortunately, he got the job done on the occasion. Did come out of it a little tired. So we decided, you know what, we're going to back off on him for the bulk of the summer and work our way backwards from the Breeders' Cup at Keeneland. Our hope is to get a prep into him in the Phoenix at Keeneland, which is what he was beating a nose in last year prior to his Breeders' Cup victory. So if we can go Phoenix, Breeders' Cup, we'd be ecstatic.
Aaron, one more question for me. And again, thank you for your time. This has been enlightening and really enjoyable. With the new Heiser rules coming in, has that helped you guys as a partnership bring in outside investors, or is it still the perception by the general public is the horse industry still needs to get their shit together, basically?
I think it's a combination of both. I really do. We got to start somewhere, right? And I know that the types of partners that Eclipse attracts are interested in integrity in all respects. And really what they want most when we send a horse out onto the playing field is for a level playing field. They want to know that our horse is standing in that starting gate with however many other competitors in the gate on the same playing field. Nobody's taking an edge or able to take an edge. And we tout that in our program. I think if you look at the trainers that we employ year in and year out, they're stand-up guys that you know, really operate the right way. So to your point, I don't think that there's any downside to the HISA. Is it attracting new owners to come through our doors and want to join an Eclipse partnership? I don't know. I don't think it can hurt. I don't think it'll detract people from wanting to come to Eclipse or any other partnership or to join the ownership ranks in general. I said this in another interview a couple weeks ago. You know, we're seeing handle rise through the roof this summer. There's really good trends, and maybe we're operating in a vacuum right now. I don't know. Again, time will tell. But if one guy decides, you know what, I'm going to open up the rubber band on my bankroll again and dip into the pool at Saratoga this weekend or at Del Mar because he's read the HISA's in effect and he feels more confidence in the wagering product and that he's got a more fair shake when he goes to bet his hard-earned dollars. There's no downside here. Are there going to be growing pains? Absolutely. Any initiative like this, especially in the political realm, is going to have bumps in the road. And we're seeing that. But I got to be honest, I've been very impressed with HISA's upper management, with Lisa Lazarus. She is willing to listen. And although change and getting it right might not be immediate and it might not be happening as fast as we all want it to be, they're trying. And we finally broke down that barrier of actually having some unified governing body as it relates to medication, at least. So we've been fighting an impossible battle for decades where we've made very little progress. And whether you agree with how it's being run or not, or you're willing to wait for these bumps in the road to be smoothed out or not, you got to admit that we're at least making some progress. And at the end of the day, we can't lose sight of the fact that the reason HISA is in effect is because we want to operate on a level playing field. If we keep our eye on the ball in that respect, we're going to be okay long term. We might have growing pains. There might be some, you know, real trauma along the way. But I think long term, look, we're all young guys. We all want to be in this business for the long haul. I think if we stay the course, we support the initiative, we're going to be in really good shape and look back on this watershed moment in 10, 15, 20 years from now and say, okay, that was the beginning of the real saving of our sport in our industry.
Bill, you were obviously excluded from that comment, Bill.
I was going to say, he said young guys. Aaron just sewed up my Eclipse Award for the Owner of the Year. Thoroughbreds. Man, thanks, Aaron.
Aaron, thank you so much for the time, man. I could listen to you all day. One of our favorite interviews. Congrats on the win, and thanks for the time, my guy.
I appreciate it. Thanks for thinking of Eclipse, guys. And, you know, you guys put your time into this every week, and it's a thankless job, but thanks for promoting the industry and bringing on interesting characters every week. I think it's a real benefit and great content. So thank you for what you guys contribute as well.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Aaron Wellman will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. Be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd. PA Day at the races. September 24th, PA Derby Day has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. PHBA celebrated a successful Pennsylvania Day at the races on Monday at Parks. The day included seven $100,000 stakes, including the first two races from their new PA Bred, PA Sire two-year-old Stallion Series. Each of those stakes attracted 12 entries. It really was a nice card, full fields. Florida Sombra won the Miss Blue Tie-Dye Stakes and is undefeated from her first two starts. Looked really good. 90% Maddie won the Whistle Pig for owner breeder LC Racing, who I'm pretty sure John is friends with. It was also announced this week that Brody's Cause, a grade one winning son of Giants Causeway, is going to be moving to Pennsylvania for the 2023 breeding season. He'll be standing at Equistar Training and Breeding. Very exciting opportunity for Pennsylvania breeders. There's only so many sons of Giants Causeway that are going to be left, you know, after we lost him in the last couple of years. So definitely a good opportunity there to get into that sire line. And of course, the highlight, the low light of the day was Chubb Wagon losing. But like Bill said, she will be back and better than ever. It was a terrific, terrific day of racing. And now we look forward to Pennsylvania Derby Day, which is actually in just a month, September 24th at Parks. Okay, you may have heard of this story at some point last week with Chad Brown, who is the leading trainer in America, I would say, the preeminent trainer. He's been champion three or four times by now. He was arrested in Saratoga for allegedly obstruction of breathing. There was a woman who made a complaint about him that it was a physical altercation and he assaulted her. Obviously, nothing is proven at this point. He did spend the night in jail on Tuesday. He was released on Wednesday with a $2,500 bail. Bill wrote the story along with Mike Kane. Bill, what did you learn?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just lay out, you know, the facts of what we learned in the story. The woman was described herself as an on-again, off-again, significant other of Chad Brown. Chad was at home and she entered into his, I mean, this is again, all alleged and this is one side of the story, et cetera. She entered into his home, she said, using a key that she had to get into his home in Saratoga. Don't want to get in the gutter, but I don't know any other way to say this, found him in bed with another woman. That led to an altercation in which she accused Chad of pushing her down the stairs and choking her. That obstruction of breathing is just a fancy word for choking. I don't know why they use that. So he spent the night in jail. The next morning at his arraignment, he pled not guilty, as you would expect, and is going to be back in court in September. I mean, it's a messy story. It's nothing to make light of, or you know, sometimes we kind of like to poke these guys, oh, trainers behaving badly. I don't want to go down that route whatsoever because this is way too serious. The only thing I'll say on this is that, you know, serious as this issue is, I do think it's important, and you kind of touch upon this, Joe, for people not to rush to judgment here. I mean, we do live in a society where you're innocent until proven guilty. He deserves his day in court. And people have said that Naira should have banned him or should have been suspended by the New York Gaming Commission. I don't think that would have been appropriate at all. I don't know where this is going from here. It's you know, a black eye for a lot of people, a lot of reasons, and just stay tuned. We'll see what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, like it's an awkward thing to report on because, like you said, this is all alleged. This isn't proven. You know, the rumor mill is spinning like crazy. There's a lot of whispers about Chad going on right now. The thing I wanted to say is that, you know, this, everything is so, all these like debates are so poisoned now on Twitter and in racing in general, where you got to take a side. You got to be like pro Chad or pro woman. And it's just like, can we just wait a little bit and see what happens and see the proceedings? Because like, there are people that are upset that, you know, TDN even reported the woman's side of the story. It's like, well, that's the news. Like that's the side of the story we have right now. So we have to report that. Nobody's saying he 100% did this and should be thrown in jail forever. But that's the story right now. And it'll be interesting to see if Chad ever says anything about this, or if there's more court proceedings, or maybe it'll be settled out of court. But obviously, it's shocking news in terms of, you know, you don't usually see big high profile people in racing get arrested, especially not for stuff like this. Like maybe for drugs, you know, but not for stuff like this. Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, and Joe and Bill, I'm glad that we're talking about it, just in the sense that it is newsworthy. It is a story, and it's an unfortunate story. Again, nothing's been proven yet, but based on the facts and circumstances, you know, we as you guys more so than me, I pretend to be a journalist, but you guys really are. You know, you have to report these stories.
Right. And this is, yeah, it's something that's a big deal no matter what. It doesn't pertain to racing necessarily. It's not like a betamethasone overage where you can have this debate back and forth, or was that the reason the horse won the race? You know, it's just where it's a little tough to pin down, like how big of an offense it is. If true, we don't know that this is true. If true, this is obviously very serious and needs to be taken care of by regulatory bodies. But obviously the process has to play out. This story, I think, has been reported extremely responsibly so far, not just at TDN, but throughout the industry. I don't see anybody, at least in the official pages of racing publications, pointing fingers or throwing him away and you know, throwing him in jail, not gonna throwing away the key. But like, this stuff has to be reported, but it's still early in the process and we need to let it play out. Like, was that so hard for everybody to say and everybody to acknowledge? Does everything have to be a war, a flame war, every time something happens? Like, this seems like the kind of thing that more people should be able to agree on at this stage.
Joe, I just want to say one more thing. And you say, you know, whether or not he would be sanctioned. Again, this is if the end of the day he is found guilty of this and only that. I don't know that there's any blueprint or template for this. I can't recall any trainer in this sport being sanctioned for off the track issue like this, like domestic violence. And so I don't know how racing handles this or deals with it. And, you know, and look at all the problems the NFL has had with this. It's been so many different examples of this. And by and large, people think the NFL has done a terrible job with how they police this. So, you know, if in fact he is at the end of the day found guilty, what would be next so far is what racing would do.
We'll pay attention to this story and we'll see. Hopefully we get some more updates, but I just wanted to switch gears and Jamie Ness, who is a big time trainer in the Mid-Atlantic states, who's won a ton of races. He's been suspended 6 months by the Pennsylvania Racing Commission. Pennsylvania Racing Commission is taking people out left and right. You love to see it. Yeah, that's like, finally, we have some cops on the beat somewhere here in America who are not afraid to kick people out or not afraid to suspend people, because they've been on a killing spree here with getting these guys out of here. And Jamie Ness is a guy who's had a ton of overages, a ton of, you know, disqualifications and a ton of issues. And, you know, he's just one of those guys who, you know, miraculously goes to different places, pops up out of nowhere and starts winning at 25-28%. It's just one of those things that defies belief. And I don't know what the specific issue was here. It says a horse he trained tested positive for bufotenine, which I don't even know what that is. He was also fined $5,000. Suspension begins September 5th, runs through March 2023. I mean, obviously there's going to be an appeals process. This isn't the end of that, but I just want to, you know, like John was clapping, I want to applaud the Pennsylvania Racing Commission, because, you know, there's so much stuff that just stinks to high heaven in this industry. And we all just are supposed to sit here and act like it's normal. And it just isn't. And Jamie Ness is one of those guys that he's had so many results and so many horses that you're just like, come on, bro. Like, especially the claims. Big claimer who claims $16,000 horses, all of a sudden they're in a stake and they're winning allowances by 5-10 lengths. It's just, I don't even care about the specific instance here. Jamie Ness is a guy who's had chance after chance after chance after chance to do things right and still has these unbelievable results. Any thoughts, guys?
Yeah. I mean, look, Joe, we obviously, you know, what we've been doing over these last 151 shows, is, you know, keep harping on this subject about, you know, we got to take care of the bad guys. We got to weed them out of the game. And, you know, I've been equally on that path as the two of you, but I take a deep breath here. And I think everybody else, I'm telling you, there's more to this story than meets the eye. And look, if Jamie Ness is a bad guy or a good guy, if he cheats or doesn't cheat, at the end of the day, just like we talked about Chad Brown, you know, this has to be proven and he has to have his day in court. And there's a lot of stuff about this that just doesn't add up. Now, the drug is called bufotenine. It's also known as toad venom. And I guess toad venom is a hallucinogenic that, you know, the same as like using mescaline or mushrooms. I see you're shaking your head, but bear with me here. The ARIC says it has no effect on the physiology of the racing animal whatsoever. It's also found in grass and then can get into the horse's system by them eating grass. Now, let's just suppose that Jamie Ness used this bufotenanine to dope horses to improve their performance. Look, I'm not a chemist. I don't know. But how on earth could giving them a hallucinogenic that comes from toads improve their performance? It reminds me a little bit about the Baffert scopolamine case with Justify, where, you know, it looks like it could have been environmental contamination. This is not like, okay, they did a test, they caught them with this drug, it's in his system, bang, you're banned for 6 months. It's a somewhat bizarre case. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that Jamie Ness is going to go down for this.
Yeah, and Bill, he might not go down for this, but I think it's kind of like similar to Baffert in the sense of he's been given so many chances and there's just, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And the guy has 108 reported regulatory infractions.
Thank you, John.
On the thoroughbred regulatory.
Of course, 75 of them for horses late to the paddock, you know, so which
I'm
is
sure. Even so, yeah. And the other thing I would say is even if there's a contaminant that they find in grass, you guys haven't been to the park's backstretch. I can tell you there is not one freaking blade of grass back there. So it's not a matter of, oh, the horse was grazing. Like, it's not like Keeneland or Kentucky Downs where there's just fields and fields of blue grass. If there's any grass back there, it's in a Ziploc bag and the guys are smoking it. There's no turf, you know, back on the racetrack. So I'm a little disappointed, I'm disappointed in the fact that, you know, Drew Mollica, who has been on the show, is a friend of the show, and I know him personally. He's actually representing Jamie Ness, and I'm a little disappointed in that. And I know he's an attorney,
everybody's entitled to a defense. Come on,
I understand. You know, I understand, you know, but I like to think
I'm already represented. Charles Manson. I mean, come
I get
on.
It. I'm not saying that
Charles Manson's getting percentage though, Bill.
I'm 34.
Wait. It's still my time. I'm not saying that Drew's a bad guy for doing it, and everyone does deserve to have legal representation. I'm saying that I've had many, many conversations with Drew, and I think he's a very down to earth guy, and I think he's an intelligent guy, and that's why I'm disappointed, because he can pick and choose what clients he wants to have, and he's claimed, you know, he's representing Jamie Ness, who, for all intents and purposes, is one of the guys that you know, training that we wouldn't run at parks because of trainers like Jamie Ness. That's why we haven't run there in 3 years, because you can't win. And Aaron Wellman said it very well in our interview when we talked to him about Heisa. And he said, as an industry, we just want to know that we have a fair shake. We want to have an even playing field. And there was never an even playing field, at least not in the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years with regard to parks. And I've been on, you know, I've been very outspoken and the, you know, some of the powers that be at parks have actually, you know, pulled me aside and reprimanded me about talking, you know, negatively about their racetrack. But you know what? I'm going to talk positively about the racetrack because I'm so happy. That's what I was clapping before. So happy that they are trying to clean up the mess that is parks racing. And if it's not on this one, if it's not on this single individual test and he'll have his day in court, it's got to be on the other, you know, 108 or whatever, even if it's 30 medication issues, because the guy's not a Hall of Fame trainer, but he's running at Hall of Fame stats.
Yeah. Just one more. First of all, you I think you gave credit to the wrong outfit. It's the Pennsylvania Racing Commission that is behind this. Parks hasn't taken any action here. All I'm saying is, and look, I don't, what you, both you and Joe have said, it, you know, I can't say I'd really disagree with it. But just trust me, this isn't as cut and dried as it might seem. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can't suspend somebody when they didn't do anything wrong. And I'm telling you, there's a case to be made here that he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, we can't be, you know, we don't do this in a kangaroo court. Right. That's all. And, you know, look, maybe at the end of the day, he'll get the 6 months and he'll go away for half a year. And then you could say, yeah. They got rid of the guy for 6 months. It's all possible. Just keep it. Just wait. Just like we said with Chad Brown, just wait and see.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I don't think it's the same as Chad Brown, because this is, as far as we know, as far as what's been reported, this is the first offense in this regard for Chad Brown.
I want to be careful because I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm not comparing domestic violence in any way to using toad venom on a horse. I just mean that when we came to, I think we all came to the conclusion that, you know, Chad Brown deserves his day in court, and we'll see what happens. That's what I'm comparing to the Jamie Ness situation.
Let's just look at some of his numbers. He's been training since 1999. He's got 3,700 career winners and a career winning percentage of 25%. Can you name a graded stakes winning horse that Jamie Ness has? How about a stakes winning horse? The guy's racked up 3,700 winners, winning at 25%, strictly almost on low-level claimers and maybe low-level allowance horses. He's got 107 wins at Parks, to John's point, 67 more than the next leading trainer. The next leading trainer has 40 winners. He's winning at 28% at Parks. He does this everywhere he goes. He goes to Tampa, he goes to Laurel, he goes to all these places. And just even if he's been out of the game for a little bit, pops up and starts winning at 30%, starts claiming off of everybody and moving horses up. Whether or not this particular incident, you know, I love John's line about the no grass at Parks, because, like, you know, everybody's got an excuse always. Like, yeah, Bill, you might be right. You might indeed be right that this is going to get overturned on appeal. And it was, you know how it is. You just walk around the street and then you get some toad venom on you and then you blow a test. Like, it happens sometimes. I get it. Common story. But I think in general, the idea to get people like Jamie Ness out of Pennsylvania racing can only help Pennsylvania racing. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV Workout of the Week, which you can see right now if you're watching the video version of this podcast, which you should always be doing, is Cyberknife, who put in his final work last Saturday for this weekend's Grade 1 Run Happy Traverse Stakes, which we're going to preview in a little bit. The son of Gunrunner worked in company with stakes winner Angitude and went 5 furlongs in 1 minute flat. He was given second choice morning line odds of 7-2 and drew post one. Don't think I'm going to get the 7.8-1 that I got on Cyberknife in the Haskell, but, you know, he is a contender. Like I said, we're going to talk about that race in a little bit. And he's, to me, to my knowledge, is the only son of Gunrunner who already has a stallion deal, but he sure as hell is not going to be the last one. So if you want to see all those Travers works, you know, Epicenter, all the top contenders, go to xbtv.com. Just type the horse's name in the search bar. They'll almost certainly have it for you. This is the weekend preview presented by Three Chimneys. We got a huge weekend coming up. Obviously, Travers Day. It's the race everybody circles on their calendar most on the Saratoga summer schedule. And, you know, it's got an 8-horse field. You'd like a couple more. The big story of the race going into it was the scratch of Charge It, which is unfortunate. You know, it's just one of those horses that, you know, just doesn't run as frequently as you would want him to. I just, you know, when the horse wins a race like he won the Dwyer, and, you know, there's 10 weeks or whatever it is to the Travers, and they're like, yeah, we're just waiting for the Travers. I'm like, okay, something can pop up with a horse like this over time. And unfortunately, that's what happened, because he was the most interesting horse in the race to me, with the 111 buyer and the 23 length win. So we're left with a field of 8. Epicenter is the, I thought, surprisingly heavy morning line favorite at 7-5. He drew post 6. We have the Derby winner in there. Rich Strike drew post 2. He's 10-1 morning line. We've got 3 horses for Chad Brown. Early voting. There's obviously the Preakness winner, Artorias and Zandon. So Chad's got 3 of the 8, still looking for his first Travers winner. That's going to be a fun interview after the race if Chad wins the Travers. But I will try to beat Epicenter again. I think he just is not that much better than these horses, although he looked tremendous in the Jim Dandy. That was a short field. I think it's going to be a little bit tougher to figure out in this race what the pace is going to be like. The good thing about Epicenter, and we've said this before, is that he's so versatile. He can be on the lead. He can be just off the lead. We saw in the Jim Dandy, he can drop back and make one run. So I totally respect him as the favorite. I just think this is a good enough Travers field that you shouldn't be taking 6-5 or 7-5 on anybody. Guys, what are your first thoughts on the Travers?
I'll take the 7-5 on him, Joe. I just think he's...
Talk eater. No.
Kind of, and he's not going to be 2-5 like Ness, but just like we said, I just think he's better than these horses. And I think he's proven that, particularly in the Jim Dandy. And, you know, his run in the Derby and Preakness were very, very good. You know, it's kind of a shame. This race is a good race, but you lost O'Donegal, you lost Charge It. It could have been really, a race with a lot of sizzle. But, you know, in Epicenter, again, if he wins this, does he clinch the 3-year-old championship? Maybe not, because a 3-year-old male could still win, of course, the Breeders' Cup Classic. It's funny too. I wouldn't bet on Rich Strike with your money, but, you know, here we have the Kentucky Derby winner is 10-1 in here, and he's hardly like he's even in the race. Nobody talks about him whatsoever. But you know, when he didn't show much in the Belmont, you know, you can go back to just saying the whole thing was a fluke. But an interesting race. Yeah, the three Chad Brown horses, Steve Aspies, and I know we'll get into the other races, but he could have an absolutely huge day on Saturday at Saratoga. And I'm an Epicenter guy. And, you know, maybe you're right overall. Maybe taking a 6-5 shot in a situation like this is not the best thing to do. But when I think he's going to win the race, I'll take the 6-5.
And I don't think we should lament the fact that, you know, a couple of big horses aren't in the race. I think we should focus on how good the field is. You have the Haskell winner, the Preakness winner, the Jim Dandy winner, the Bluegrass winner. Oh, and the Kentucky Derby winner also. So you have five horses that won, you know, arguably the most important three-year-old races of the country, other than the Belmont. And they're going to go head to head to head to head to head. They're all going to go mano a mano. And I think that, you know, early voting, who put in a clunker in the Jim Dandy, but before that he was second choice in that race. And if they figured out why he whether he bounced or what have you, what his issue was in the Jim Dandy, he's going to be really tough. And he's morning line 8-1. And Bill, you mentioned it, the Kentucky Derby winner is 10-1 in the race. You know, so it's a very good field. It's a very deep field. And it's probably as tough of a field, you know, at least in the contenders range, since 2018, when Catholic Boy went up against Mendelssohn, Vino Rosso, Gronkowski, Good Magic, and Wonder Godot. So, you know, that was the last time, in my estimation, when we had a field of top three-year-olds coming in and just waging war against each other in the Travers. I dare to say, I think that this is a better field overall than the Kentucky Derby was, quite frankly. And, you know, the reason being is you have all these horses that are now pointed for this race. They're getting, you know, this is going to be, you know, like I said, a grade zero kind of race. I think that we're going to look back at this race, especially come, you know, when these horses are starting to retire to become stallions. And we're going to say, boy, remember when so-and-so, fill in the blank, won the Travers? That catapulted him to the three-year-old championship.
153rd running of the Run Happy Travers. Did I say Run Happy the first time? I don't want Mac to get mad at me. So it's going to be a great day of racing. I'm looking at the weather right now. It looks like we're going to be okay. Let me see. Yeah. Saturday looks beautiful at Saratoga. 81 degrees, partly sunny. Anybody that's going to be out there, have a great, great time. But Bill brings up an interesting point about the three-year-old championship, because Epicenter, as much as he's done and as heavy as a favorite he's going to be, he still doesn't have a grade one win as a three-year-old. So that's important. He's got the Risen Star. He's got the Louisiana Derby. He's got the Jim Dandy. He did run second, obviously, in the Derby and the Preakness. So he's definitely the leader right now. But say Cyberknife wins this race, that'll be his third grade one win of the year. He won the Arkansas Derby. He won the Haskell. If Cyberknife wins, he's the new leader in the three-year-old division. So, you know, as much as we respect Epicenter, as much as we think he's the horse to beat, and he's had a very good campaign, very consistent campaign, This is not a layup race for him at all, and it's not a layup that he's going to be three-year-old champion. Now, obviously, if he wins this race, he's going to be tough to catch. But that's the subplot in here, is that, like John says, you have a bunch of grade one winners in here who could take the lead in the three-year-old champion race. You know, and it'd be nice actually to see some drama in that, because I think, like we said, Nest is basically a foregone conclusion now in the three-year-old filly division. So it's going to be interesting to see coming out of this race how we feel about the three-year-old class. And I think overall we felt like this is an above average crop. You know, we've lost a couple of horses here and there along the way, but it's going to be interesting coming out of this race to analyze how we think these horses are going to run against the elders later in the year. And I think so a lot of that depends on how Flightline does in the Pacific Classic, because you've got a very, very strong group of older males. So it'll be interesting to see coming out of here where we think that the three-year-olds stack up, because after this, they got to take on the older horses, and we'll look forward to that for sure.
Joe, just because this reminds me all the time, can we at least mention Ain't Life Grand and Gilded Age? They're running also, just so we did talk about them on the show.
Ain't Life Grand won the Iowa Derby over Conagher, who came back and ran a big race. I think we might see Conagher in the H. Allen Jerkins, which we're going to talk about after this break. But yes, thank you. Thank you for the Remy reminder to mention every horse in the race so we don't get yelled at by anybody. The TDN Writers Room, and more specifically, this weekend preview segment is sponsored by Three Chimneys Stallions. It was another week, another TDN Rising Star for Three Chimneys superstar sire, Gunrunner Echo Again, who we mentioned, or who John mentioned earlier, looked terrific. Winchell Homebred is the sixth Rising Star already for last year's freshman sire and horse of the year, Gunrunner, who was campaigned by the same connections. Zecco again, Gunrunner, had another impressive juvenile winner on Sunday, who I mentioned with Grand Love, homebred for Three Chimneys, looks very speedy, and he's got a big weekend ahead with multiple grade one winners. Cyberknife, who has a huge chance coming up in the Travers. Preakness Hero, early voting, another good chance in the Travers. And he's got some horses on the undercard that we're going to talk about a little bit. And we'll be right back after this message from Three Chimneys.
Here comes Tama. Tama in the center of the track with good looking stride, squares off with Cyberknife. Cyberknife takes the lead. Tama going with him. These two in a thriller. Cyberknife just in front. And Cyberknife has won the TVG.com Haskell over Tama. Jack Christopher finished third. The running time, 1:46.24.
Gunrunner's on top of the world.
Come dream with us at Three Chimneys.
And it's all Tyler's Tribe to the final furlong. He's putting on another show tonight. He is 8 lengths in front. Now it's 10, now it's 12. Tyler's Tribe pouring it on as they come down to the line. He's going to win by double digits, and he stops the clock in 1:04.
All right, so we had a bunch of other big stakes on Saturday at Saratoga and over the weekend, honestly, because they moved the Ballerina this year to Sunday, which I like. I like having that big race to look forward to the day after the Travers. Like, my feeling on these big mega cards is they're great, but they kind of cannibalize the rest of the racing schedule. So I'm glad they put the Ballerina on Sunday. It's a nice sleepy day after the Travers, and you still have something to get excited about. But as for the Travers Day undercard, we've got the Forgo, we've got the H. Allen Jerkins, we've got the Personal Ensign, and the Sword Dancer. All four of those are grade ones. We also have the Ballston Spa, which is a grade two for fillies and mares on the turf. So in total, 6 graded stakes, 5 grade ones. And not to forget, we also have the Pat O'Brien on Saturday at Del Mar as well, which I think Speaker's Corner is going to ship across the country and just avoid Flightline by about a week or so. And I think he's probably going to be the horse to beat him there. I think the most exciting race, usually, other than the Travers on this day, is the H. Allen Jerkins, because you do get those three-year-olds where the trainers have finally thrown in the towel on them becoming routers and are like, let's just focus on 7 furlongs to a mile or 6 furlongs. And that's, I think, when you get the most brilliant performances, when horses maybe were chasing the Triple Crown Trail a little bit, cut back and are now doing what they were born to do. We saw it last year with Life is Good and Jackie's Warrior. That was the race of the year for my money. This year looks like we're going to have a pretty big field. Gunite, son of Gunrunner, who won the Amsterdam earlier in this meet, is going to be in there. Conniger, who I also mentioned, a really, really nice fast horse for Mike Tomlinson, is going to be in there. Jack Christopher. I think Jack Christopher is turning back for this, right, guys?
He's in the pro.
Yeah. So Jack Christopher is going to be in there. Howling Time, who I read a pretty good race in the Met win. Running Son of a Gun, who's also a gun runner. So Gun Runner is going to be well represented in that race. Just looking at the Sword Dancer, we have Gaffoe and Channelmaker, Adamo, Nice Horses, Tribuven. I was hoping that they would run Warlike Goddess in here. Bill Mott hinted after the last race that now that the Flower Bowl is a grade two, that he might run her in the Sword Dancer. I don't see her in the probables. Like I said, on Sunday, the Ballerina looks like a really good race with CC and Obligatory. The Forgo is going to have John's favorite horse, the Saratoga horse for the course, Baby Yoda. So I know it's going to be appointment viewing for John. Mind Control's in there. Jackie's Warrior, obviously, is appointment viewing. 3-2 Zone, who was pretty sharp in an allowance win earlier in the meet. Personal Ensign looks like we're going to have a short field, but we're going to get Latruska, Malathot, Clarier, Search Results. So I think it's going to be a power-packed field, even if it's a short field. So we'll be looking forward to that one. So what do you guys think? What out of what I just said, or maybe something off the board, what are you looking forward to most on Saturday?
Well, obviously, other than the Travers, the Forgo doesn't figure to be a competitive race because Jackie's Warrior is just so good. You know, is he going to go out at 1-5 and win again? But when he was so dominant in the Vanderbilt, and, you know, that was the race that we're all saying, this is the most impressive thing I've seen since, you know, fill in the blank. You know, is he going to go out and do that again to run a performance where you're just, you know, like you're just mesmerized by how great he was? So, I mean, I was looking forward to that. I tell you, I'm looking forward to the Personal Ensign as well, because I want to see if Latruska can bounce back. I mean, last time we saw her in the Ogden Phipps, she got beat 36 lengths. Now, was that just a complete fluke? Just like in the Breeders' Cup Distaff, she got beat a mile. It looks to me that if she faces any kind of pace pressure whatsoever, she's vulnerable. That she needs to get that loose on the lead trip. But I remember this time last year, we were talking about her as a possible horse of the year contender. And, as good as Claire Eyre is, if the real Latruska shows up, I think Latruska could beat her. But I have no idea what to expect in there. And Jack Christopher, it would have been nice if he won the Haskell and then he might be back in the Travers. And we'd be talking about this great showdown with Epicenter, Jack Christopher, a couple others. But they're doing the right thing. He obviously doesn't want to go a mile and a quarter. So the Breeders' Cup Classic is out. And let's see what he can do in the Alan Jerkins.
This weekend really revolves around those two grade ones that we've been talking about, the Travers and the H. Allen Jerkins. When you have a horse like Jack Christopher cutting back in distance, accretive looks like, he's two for two. He won first time out and then almost won the Amsterdam, just losing barely to Gnight. And then you have Conagher, which you mentioned, Gnight and Happy Jack. And these are all legitimate horses. And I'm curious to see how they can go the 7 furlongs. And I'm also curious to see just how fast they run in comparison to the older boys, because, this is definitely a race that they're all starting to get together and they're going to bottleneck in the Breeders' Cup sprint. So I'm very curious to see just how the young guns, the 3-year-olds, run in the Jerkins time-wise against the older horses that will be running later on that day.
Yep. And you guys bring up a good point with Jackie's Warrior too, because like this is when he's chasing horse of the year, like, I don't know. I think Joel might want to let him run a little bit in the stretch this time, because this is kind of Joel's MO. And I think it's very smart in general. It's just don't exert your horse any more than they need to, especially when you're on a horse who's so much the best. I don't know. I think if you want horse of the year, you want him to put on a show in this race and go win off by 6, 8, 10 lengths, which is going to be hard because it's a legitimate grade one field. But I think this is the day for Jackie's Warrior to really be allowed to strut his stuff if they want that Horse of the Year title, which I'm sure they do. And Kirk Robinson, and shout out to Kirk and Judy Robinson, fans and friends of the show, and we'll be rooting for them, obviously. But yeah, I think this is the day to let Jackie's Warrior do his thing. But yeah, it's going to be a tremendous, tremendous day of racing. My hope is that it won't be too chalky. It's interesting that you guys bring up about the personal ends in, because who's going to go with Latruska? Like, Search Results went with her in the Ogden Phipps. But then Search Results was third and was going the wrong direction. So it'll be interesting to see how that race is ridden, because I think you're right that if Latruska gets loose, she still is probably the same horse and is going to run away with the race, or not run away with the race, but is going to be tough to reel in. But I think that there's going to be somebody who's going to put some kind of pressure on her, seeing what happened in the Ogden Phipps and seeing what happened in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. So plenty of subplots. Plenty of grade one races on Saturday. Good luck to all the connections. We want great, safe racing. Like we said, it's going to be beautiful weather. So everybody have a great time at Saratoga on Saturday, and we'll be back next week to wrap it all up. The TDN Riders Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. This was the weekend that West Point got their 1,000th win. It happened on Sunday at Saratoga with Phantom Smoke, who won a turf sprint. West Point is in their 32nd year of racing and has amassed 138 stakes wins, 60 graded stakes wins, 15 grade one wins, and over $63 million in purse earnings. Terry was quoted afterwards saying he's most proud they've never had a horse test positive on a drug test. And honestly, I'm not just saying this because they're a sponsor. West Point has been a longtime champion of the game. They do things the right way. They deserve the biggest of hat tips for getting to 1,000 wins. For any owner, that's an unbelievable accomplishment, and their footprint just grows every single year. And they have a great team. Terry does a great job, but everybody behind the scenes, Tom Bellhouse is his main guy, but all of the partners, everybody behind West Point has done a great job to get to this mark, and they really deserve all the kudos, and we wish continued success to them. And also Katie Petruniak, our associate producer, had a story this week talking to the people at West Point about their 1,000th win and how much that meant to them. So definitely go check that out. So we're looking forward to the next 1,000 to Terry and the gang. We really appreciate you guys, and congratulations once again. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills, experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy has almost 100 yearlings cataloged for the upcoming Keeneland September sale. So we'll be taking a look at a few of those in the coming weeks. They have two yearlings in book one, both by Gunrunner, sponsor of their show. It's basically Gunrunner sponsoring the show. Three Chimneys is technically sponsoring the show, but Gunrunner has been so unbelievable that he takes up all the air. Hip 21 is a Gunrunner half-sister to multiple stakes winner offering plan. I remember her in the New York ranks. She's also from the family of grade two winner Adore the Gold. Hip 125 is a Gunrunner colt out of stakes winner Aquafresh. His family also includes multiple graded stakes winner and grade one Breeders' Cup juvenile runner-up Repent. Remember Repent, guys? He was nice horse. Ran well in the Travers, too. So go check out Tommy and Wendy's consignment at Legacy at Keeneland September. They'll have everything you need, and they'll take care of you as a small shop. They'll take care of you and give you the personal attention that you deserve. This week's Remy cartoon, we got a couple of guys. We're being presented with a giant Trojan horse from another barn. And the quote is, "How thoughtful that other trainer sent me a new horse." And I'm sure there are plenty of trainers out there, maybe want to get rid of some lower level stock, who would disguise it as a Trojan horse and send it down the Saratoga backstretch. Shout out to Remy as always. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, I'm sure you couldn't forget, but don't forget, the Keeneland September sale begins Monday, September 12th. It runs through September 24th. You can check out the catalog, which has over 4,100 offerings at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Aaron Wellman, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. Enjoy Travers Day. See you next week.